The Electric Railway, abridged from Edison, has life and inventions by Frank Lewis Dyer and Thomas Comerford Martin. Edison had no sooner designed his dynamo in 1879 than he adopted the same form of machine for use as a motor. The two are shown in the Scientific American of October 18, 1879, and are alike, except that the dynamo is vertical and the motor lies in a horizontal position. The article remarking, "Its construction differs but slightly from the electric generator." It will probably surprise many people to know that he was the inventor of an electric motor before he perfected his incandescent lamp. His interest in the subject went back to his connection with General Lefferts in the days of the evolution of the stock ticker. While Edison was carrying on his shop at Newark, New Jersey, there was considerable excitement in electrical circles over the Payne motor in regard to the alleged performance, of which Governor Cornell of New York and other wealthy capitalists were quite enthusiastic. Payne had a shop in Newark, and in one small room was the motor, weighing perhaps 600 pounds. It was of circular form, encased in iron, with the ends of several small magnets sticking through the floor. A pulley and belt connected to a circular saw larger than the motor permitted large logs of oak timber to be sawed with ease with the use of two small cells of battery. Edison's friend, General Lefferts, had become excited and was determined to invest a large sum of money in the motor company. But knowing Edison's intimate familiarity with all electrical subjects, he was wise enough to ask his young expert to go and see the motor with him. At an appointed hour, Edison went to the office of the motor company and found there the venerable Professor Morse, Governor Cornell, General Lefferts, and many others who had been invited to witness a performance of the motor. They all proceeded to the room where the motor was at work. Payne put a wire in the binding post of the battery. The motor started, and an assistant began sawing a heavy oak log. It worked beautifully, and so great was the power developed apparently from the small battery that Morse exclaimed, "I am thankful that I have lived to see this day." But Edison kept a close watch on the motor. The results were so foreign to his experience that he knew there was a trick in it. He soon discovered it. While holding his hand on the frame of the motor, he noticed a tremble coincident with the exhaust of an engine across the alleyway, and he then knew that the power came from the engine by a belt under the floor, shifted on and off by a magnet, the other magnets being a blind. He whispered to the general to put his hand on the frame of the motor, watch the exhaust, and note the coincident tremor. The general did so, and in about 15 seconds he said, "Well, Edison, I must go now. This thing is a fraud." And thus he saved his money. A few years later, in 1878, Edison went to Wyoming. He noticed the long hauls to market or elevator that the farmers had to make with their loads of grain at great expense, and conceived the idea that his ordinary steam railroad service was too costly. Light electric railways might be constructed that could be operated automatically over simple tracks, the propelling motors being controlled at various points. Cheap to build and cheap to maintain, such roads would be a great boon to the newer farming regions of the West, where highways were still of the crudest character, and where transportation was the gravest difficulty with which settlers had to contend. The plan seems to have haunted him, and he had no sooner worked out a generator and motor that, owing to their low internal resistance, could be operated efficiently, that he turned his hand to the practical trial of such a railroad, applicable to both the haulage of freight and the transportation of passengers. Early in 1880, when the tremendous rush of work involved in the invention of the incandescent lamp intermitted a little, he began the construction of a stretch of track close to Menlo Park Laboratory, and at the same time built an electric locomotive to operate over it. This is a fitting stage at which to review briefly what had been done in electric traction up to that date. The honor of the first attempt of any kind appears to rest with this country and with Thomas Davenport, a self-trained blacksmith of Brandon, Vermont, who made a small model of a circular electric railway and cars in 1834 and exhibited it the following year in Springfield, Boston, and other cities. Of course, he depended upon batteries for current, but the fundamental idea was embodied of using the track for the current, one rail being positive and the other negative, and the motor being placed across or between them in multiple arc to receive the current. The first broad patent taken out by this simple mechanic so far ahead of his times was the first one issued in America for an electric motor. Davenport was also the first man to apply electric power to the printing press in 1840. In his traction work, he had a close second in Robert Davidson of Aberdeen, Scotland, who in 1839 operated both a lathe and a small locomotive with the motor he had invented. In 1879, at the Berlin Exhibition, the distinguished firm of Siemens, to whose ingenuity and enterprise electrical development owes so much, installed a road about one-third of a mile in length, over which the locomotive hauled a train of three small cars at a speed of about 8 miles an hour, carrying some 20 persons every trip. Current was fed from a dynamo to the motor through a central third track, the two outer rails being joined together as a negative or return circuit. Primitive but essentially successful, this little road made a profound impression on the minds of many inventors and engineers. But it is not to be supposed that on the part of the public there was any great amount of faith then discernible, and for some years the pioneers had great difficulty, especially in this country, in raising money for their early modest experiments. Edison's experimental electric rail went into operation as the result of hard and hurried work of preparation during the spring months. The first track was about a third of a mile in length, starting from the shops, passing around a hill at the rear and curving home in the general form of the letter U. The rails were very light. Charles T. Hughes, who went with Edison in 1879 and was in charge of much of the work, states that they were second streetcar rails, insulated with tar, canvas paper, and things of that sort, asphalt. They were spiked down on ordinary sleepers laid upon the natural grade, and the gauge was about 3 feet 6 inches. At one point, the grade dropped some 60 feet in a distance of 300, and the curves were of recklessly short radius. The dynamos supplying current to the road were originally two of the standard Z machines then being made at the laboratory, popularly known throughout the Edison ranks as long-waisted Mary Ann's, and the circuits from these were carried out to the rails by underground conductors. They were not large, about 12 horsepower each, generating 75 amperes of current at 110 volts, so that not quite 25 horsepower of electrical energy was available for propulsion. The locomotive built while the roadbed was getting ready was a four-wheeled iron truck, an ordinary flat dump car about 6 feet long and 4 feet wide, upon which was mounted a Z dynamo used as a motor, so that it had a capacity of about 12 horsepower. This machine was laid on its side, and the armature was coming out at the front of the locomotive, and the motive power was applied to the driving axle by a cumbersome series of friction pulleys. Each wheel of the locomotive had a metal rim and a center web of wood or paper mache, and the current picked up by one set of wheels was carried through contact brushes and a brass hub to the motor, the circuit back to the track or other rail being closed through the other wheels in a similar manner. The motor had its field magnet circuit in permanent connection as a shunt across the rails, protected by a crude bare copper wire safety catch. A switch in the armature circuit enabled the motorman to reverse the direction of travel by reversing the current flow through the armature coils. Things went fairly well for a while on that memorable Thursday afternoon when all the laboratory force made a high holiday and scrambled for a foothold on the locomotive for a trip. But the friction gearing was not equal to the sudden strain put upon it during one run and went to pieces. The next resort of medicine was to belts, the armature shafting belted to a countershaft on the locomotive frame, and the countershaft belted to a pulley on the car axle. The lever which threw the former friction gear into adjustment was made to operate an idler pulley for tightening the axle belt. When the motor was started, the armature was brought up to full revolution, and then the belt was tightened on the car axle, compelling motion of the locomotive. But the belts were liable to slip a great deal in the process, and the chafing of the belts charred them badly. If that did not happen, and if the belt was made taut suddenly, the armature burned out, which it did with disconcerting frequency. The next step was to use a number of resistance boxes in series with the armature, so that the locomotive could start with those in circuit, and then the motorman could bring it up to speed gradually by cutting one box out after the other. To stop the locomotive, the armature circuit was opened by a main switch, stopping the flow of current, and then brakes were applied by long levers. Matters generally, and the motors in particular, went much better, even if the locomotive was so freely festooned with resistance boxes, all of perceptible weight and occupying much of the limited space. These details show forcibly and typically the painful steps of advance that every inventor in this new field had to make in the effort to reach not only commercial practicality, but mechanical feasibility. It was all empirical enough, but that was the only way open even to the highest talent. Edison ingeniously wound some copper resistance wire around one of the legs of the motor field magnet, where it was out of the way, served as a useful extra field coil in starting up the motor, and dismissed most of the boxes back to the laboratory, a few being retained under the seat for chance emergencies. Like the boxes, the coil was in series with the armature, and subject to plugging in and out at will by the motorman. Thus equipped, the locomotive was found quite satisfactory, and long did yeoman service. It was given three cars to pull, one an open awning car with two park benches placed back to back, one a flat freight car, and one box car dubbed the Pullman, with which Edison illustrated a system of electric braking. Although work had been begun so early in the year and the road had been operating since May, it was not until July that Edison executed any application for patents on his electromagnetic railway engine or his ingenious braking system. Every inventor knows how largely his fate lies in the hands of a competent and alert patent attorney in both the preparation and the prosecution of his case. The daily newspapers and technical journals lost no time in bringing the road to public attention, and the New York Herald of June 25th was swift to suggest that here was the locomotive that would be most pleasing to the average New Yorker, whose head has ached with noise, whose eyes have been filled with dust, or whose clothes have been ruined with oil. A couple of days later, the Daily Graphic illustrated and described the road and published a sketch of 100-horsepower electric locomotives for use on the Pennsylvania Railroad between Perth Amboy and Rahway. Visitors, of course, were numerous, including many curious, skeptical railroad managers, few, if any of whom, except Villard, could see the slightest use for the new motive power. There is perhaps some excuse for such indifference. No men in the world have more new inventions brought to them than railroad managers, and this was the rankest kind of novelty. It was not indeed until a year later, in May 1881, that the first regular road collecting fares was put in operation. A little stretch of 1.5 miles from Berlin to Lichterfeld with one miniature motor car. Edison was in reality doing some heavy electric railway engineering, his apparatus full of ideas, suggestions, prophecies, But to the operator of long trunk lines, it must have seemed utterly insignificant and excellent fooling. Speaking of this situation, Mr. Edison says, one day Frank Thompson, the president of the Pennsylvania Railroad, came out to see the electric light and electric railway in operation. The latter was then about a mile long. He wrote on it, "At that time I was getting out plans to make an electric locomotive of 300 horsepower with 6-foot drivers, with the idea of showing people that they could dispense with their steam locomotives. Mr. Thompson made the objection that it was impractical and that it would be impossible to supplant steam. His great experience and standing threw a wet blanket on my hopes. But I thought he might perhaps be mistaken, as there had been many such instances on record. I continued to work on the plans, and about 3 years later I started to build the locomotive at the works at Girk Street, and had it about finished when I was switched off on some other work. One of the reasons why I felt the electric railway to be eminently practical was that Henry Villard, the president of the Northern Pacific, said that one of the greatest things that could be done would be to build right-angle feeders into the wheat fields of Dakota and bring in the wheat to the main lines, as the farmers then had to draw it from 40 to 80 miles. There was a point where it would not pay to raise it at all, and large areas of the country were thus of no value. I conceived the idea of building a very light railway of narrow gauge, and had all the data as to the winds on the plains, and found that it would be possible with very large windmills to supply enough power to drive those wheat trains. Among others who visited the little road at this juncture were persons interested in the Manhattan Elevated System of New York, on which experiments were repeatedly tried later, but which was not destined to adopt a method so obviously well suited to all the conditions until after many successful demonstrations had been made on elevated roads elsewhere. It must be admitted that Mr. Edison was not very profoundly impressed with the desire entertained in that quarter to utilize any improvement, for he remarks, "When the elevated railroad in New York up 6th Avenue was started, there was a great clamor about the noise and injunctions were threatened. The management engaged me to make a report on the cause of the noise. I constructed an instrument that would record the sound, and set out to make a preliminary report. But I found that they never intended to do anything but let the people complain." It was upon the cooperation of Villard that Edison fell back, and an agreement was entered into between them on September 14, 1881, which provided that the latter would build 2.5 miles of electric railway at Menlo Park, equipped with 3 cars, 2 locomotives, 1 for freight and 1 for passengers, capacity of latter 60 miles an hour. Capacity freight engine, 10 tons of net freight, cost of handling 1 ton of freight per mile per horsepower to be less than ordinary locomotive. If experiments are successful, Villard to pay actual outlays and experiments, and to treat with the light company for the installation of at least 50 miles of electric railroads in the wheat regions. Mr. Edison is authority for the statement that Mr. Villard advanced between $35,000 and $40,000, and that the work done was very satisfactory. But it did not end at that time in any practical results, as the Northern Pacific went into the hands of a receiver, and Mr. Villard's ability to help was hopelessly crippled. The directors of the Edison Electric Light Company could not be induced to have anything to do with the electric railway, and Mr. Insull states that the money advanced was treated by Mr. Edison as a personal loan and repaid to Mr. Villard, for whom he had a high admiration and a strong feeling of attachment. Mr. Insull says, "Among the financial men whose close personal friendship Edison enjoyed, I would mention Henry Villard, who I think had a higher appreciation of the possibilities of the Edison system than probably any other man of his time in Wall Street." In speaking of his relationship with Mr. Villard at this time, Edison says, "When Villard was all broken down and in a stupor caused by his disasters in connection with the Northern Pacific, Mrs. Villard sent for me to come and cheer him up. It was very difficult to rouse him from his despair and apathy, but I talked about the electric light to him and its development, and told him it would help him win it all back and put him in his former position. Villard made his great rally. He made money out of the electric light and got back control of the Northern Pacific. Under no circumstances can a hustler be kept down. If he's only square, he's bound to get back on his feet. Villard has often been blamed and severely criticized, but he was not the only one to blame. His engineers had spent $20 million too much in building the road, and it was not his fault if he found himself short of money and at that time unable to raise more. Villard maintained his intelligent interest in electric railway development, with regard to which Mr. Edison remarks, "At one time, Villard got the idea that he would run the mountain division of the Northern Pacific Railway by electricity. He asked me if it could be done. I said, certainly, it's too easy for me to undertake. Let someone else do it. He said, I want you to tackle the problem, and he insisted on it. So I got up a scheme of a third rail and shoe and erected it in my yard here in Orange. When I got it all ready, he had his division engineers come on to New York, and they came over here. I showed them my plans, and the unanimous decision of the engineers was that it was absolutely and utterly impractical. That system is on the New York Central now, and was also used on the New Haven Road in its first work with electricity. Incidental glimpses of this work are both amusing and interesting. Hughes, who was working on the experimental road with Mr. Edison, tells the following story. Villard sent J.C. Henderson, one of his mechanical engineers, to see the road when it was in operation, and we went down one day, Edison, Henderson, and I, and went on the locomotive. Edison ran it, and just after we started there was a trestle 60 feet long and 7 feet deep, and Edison put on all the power. When we went over it, we must have been going 40 miles an hour, and I could see the perspiration come out on Henderson. After we got over the trestle and started on down the track, Henderson said, "When we go back, I will walk. If there is any more of that kind of running, I won't be in it myself." To the correspondence of Grosvenor P. Lowry, we are indebted for a similar reminiscence, under date of June 5, 1880. Goddard and I have spent a part of the day at Menlo, and all is glorious. I have ridden at 40 miles an hour on Mr. Edison's electric railway, and we ran off the track. I protested at the rate of speed over the sharp curves, designed to show the power of the engine, but Edison said they had done it often. Finally, when the last trip was to be taken, I said I did not like it, but would go along. The train jumped the track on a short curve, throwing Crucy, who was driving the engine, with his face down in the dirt, and another man in a comical somersault through some underbrush. Edison was off in a minute, jumping and laughing and declaring it a most beautiful accident. Crucy got up, his face bleeding and a good deal shaken, and I shall never forget the expression of voice and the face in which he said, with some foreign accent, "Oh, yes, perfectly safe." Fortunately, no other hurts were suffered, and in a few minutes we had the train on the track and running again. In the spring of 1883, the Electric Railway Company of America was incorporated in the state of New York with a capital of $2 million to develop the patents and inventions of Edison and Stephen D. Field, to the latter of whom the practical work of active development was confided, and in June of the same year an exhibit was made at the Chicago Railway Exposition, which attracted attention throughout the country and did much to stimulate the growing interest in electric railway work. A track and locomotive were constructed for the company by Mr. Field and put in service in the gallery at the main exhibition building. The track curved sharply at either end on a radius of 56 feet, and the length was about 1/3 of a mile. The locomotive, named the Judge after Justice Field, an uncle of Stephen D. Field, took current from a central rail between the other two rails that were the return circuit, the contact being a rubbing wire brush on each side of the third rail, answering the same purpose as the contact shoe of later date. The locomotive weighed 3 tons, was 12 feet long, 5 feet wide, and made a speed of 9 miles an hour with a trailer car for passengers. Starting on June 5th, when the exhibition closed on June 23rd, this tiny but typical road had operated for over 118 hours and had made over 446 miles, and had carried 26,805 passengers. After the exposition closed, the outfit was taken during the same year to the exposition at Louisville, Kentucky, where it was also successful carrying a large number of passengers. It deserves note that at Chicago, regular railway tickets were issued to paying passengers, the first ever employed on American Electric Railways. Edison retained a very lively interest in electric railway progress long after the pregnant days at Menlo Park, one of the best evidences of which is an article in the New York Electrical Engineer of November 18, 1891, which describes some important and original experiments in the direction of adapting electrical conditions to the larger cities. The overhead trolley had by that time begun its victorious career, but there was intense hostility displayed toward it in many places because of the inevitable increase in the number of overhead wires, which, carrying as they did a current of high voltage and large quantity, were regarded as a menace to life and property. Edison has always manifested a strong objection to overhead wires in cities and urged placing them underground. And the outcry against the overhead deadly trolley met with his instant sympathy. His study of the problem brought him to the development of the modern substation. Mr. Villard, as president of the Edison General Electric Company, requested Mr. Edison, as electrician of the company, to devise a street railway system which should be applicable to the largest cities, where the use of the trolley would not be permitted, where the slot conduit system would not be used, and where, in general, the details of construction should be reduced to the simplest form. The limits imposed practically were such as to require that the system should not cost more than a cable road to install. Edison reverted to his ingenious lighting plan of the years earlier, and thus settled on a method by which current could be conveyed from the power plant at high potential to motor generators placed below the ground in close proximity to the rails. These substations would convert the current received at a pressure of, say, 1,000 volts to one of 20 volts available between rail and rail, with a corresponding increase in the volume of the current. With the utilization of heavy currents at low voltage, it became necessary, of course, to devise apparatus which should be able to pick up with absolute certainty 1,000 amperes of current at this pressure through 2 inches of mud, if necessary. With his vaunted activity and fertility, Edison set about devising such a contact and experimented with metal wheels under all conditions of speed and track conditions. It was several months before he could convey 100 amperes by means of such contacts, but he worked out at last a satisfactory device which was equal to the task. The next point was to secure a joint between contiguous rails such as would permit the passage of several thousand amperes without introducing undue resistance. This was also accomplished. Further interesting experiments showed that the expected large leakage of current from the rails in wet weather did not materialize. Edison found that under the worst conditions with a wet and salted track, at a potential difference of 20 volts between the two rails, the extreme loss was only 2.5 horsepower. In this respect, the phenomenon followed the same rule as to that which telegraph wires are subject, namely, that the loss of insulation is greater in damp, murky weather, when the insulators are covered with wet dust, than during heavy rains when the insulators are thoroughly washed by the action of the water. In like manner, a heavy rainstorm cleaned the tracks from the accumulation due chiefly to the dropping of the horses, which otherwise served largely to increase the conductivity. Of course, in dry weather, the loss of current was practically nothing, and under ordinary conditions, Edison held, his system was, in respect to leakage and the problems of electrolytic attack of the current on adjacent pipes, etc., as fully insulated as the standard trolley network of the day. The cost of his system, Mr. Edison placed, at from $30,000 to $100,000 per mile of double track, in accordance with local conditions, and in this respect comparing very favorably with the cable systems then so much in favor for heavy traffic. All the arguments that could be urged in support of this ingenious system are tenable and logical at the present moment, but the trolley had its way except on a few lines where the conduit and shoe method was adopted, and in the intervening years, the volume of traffic created and handled by electricity in centers of dense population has brought into existence the modern subway.